Well, you want more?
Absolutely.
That's why we're here.
You don't miss
it. Well, what we've just done is try to define these terms a little bit, because she kind of assumes we know it. I think a very good description of the anima. And I almost think you can, for every place she puts anima, put in animus. Maybe not quite. There's a slight difference. But maybe there's enough similarity that we don't even have to worry about the difference. Anyway, that's something we can try to figure out as we go along. But there at the bottom of the page, a good description. The anima appears as an irrational sort of temperament or disposition. So that's why it's so hard to get a grasp of it. You take your disposition as normative, but in fact, it's being shaped by something. Why are some people cheery, some people sanguine, and so on? These figures are the images behind your habitual disposition.
And if you were going to say that for the animus, would you phrase it differently? Like if you're going to say a little...
Well, the classic distinction is the anima is about feeling, and the animus is about thought. I just don't think that holds water anymore. Because I know men who act like what we used to call animus-possessed women, and I know women who act like anima men. I think typically I would say the accent for the animus would be a little more on her mental outlook. I take that with a grain of salt.
If you're speaking to a room almost entirely full of women, we kind of need to know this.
Yeah. Well, she will get into the animus at the end of the chapter. Okay. But she spends more time on the anima.
So I go on along where you were sanguine, you know, those four mm-hmm. temperaments, what I can't remember on the way. Sanguine,
yeah.
Melancholy,
yeah.
choleric, and sanguine.
Phlegmatic.
So is that kind mm-hmm. of getting at
yeah.
it?
Yeah, absolutely. Not kind of, it is getting at it.
Okay, so could you describe those four more?
I don't even know what they are.
But that would be a mental outlook, is that?
Yeah, well... You see, as soon as I try to define it, I feel it's way too narrow. But
yeah.
for the sake of discussion, a sanguine is sad, right? No.
That's blood.
Yeah. Yeah.
Emotional.
Emotional. Yeah.
Yeah. Might be easier to think in terms of national type. So sanguine would be Italian, mm-hmm. probably, right? Mm-hmm. What's mental?
Mm.
I thought
phlegmatic
was like calm, or almost sluggish.
Yeah.
Phlegmatic is almost sluggish.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Maybe we can't do it in terms of nations.
Yeah.
Think of the difference between Germans and Italians.
Mm-hmm.
An Italian is going to act emotionally differently, and they're going to think differently. German is going to act much more restrained. And with thoughts that are more restrained. So you could say the emotional side would be the anima, and the mental side would be the animus. But I think part of the problem has been that really there isn't much distinction anymore. Thanks to women's lib, basically.
Do you think that even though people like our age, even though we're kind of brought up a certain way, do you think that's still true?
Yeah, I mean, typically a woman in Jung's day was never a professional. Mm-hmm. Well, you couldn't exist in the professional world if your mind wasn't working. Mm-hmm. But compare Barbie with Bette Midler. There's been such a change. I can tell you the way I feel it is the anima, negative anima puts me to sleep. And the negative animus wakes me up. That's how I feel it.
The negative anima puts you to sleep?
Yeah. It's like I'm saying, now, for God's sakes, how could you be so stupid? To the negative anima. Uh-huh. Where the negative animus, I want to debate point by point. It's a different reaction. The one is an emotional reaction. It's like, and it's not even worth talking about. Mm-hmm. Where the animus is, let's talk about this. Mm-hmm. Generally means, let's argue about it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So are they related almost to the different functions?
Well, again, typically you would have said the in the old days where women were supposed to be feeling and mm-hmm. and men thinking that, yeah.
I mean, I'm talking about the way you're talking about it. Like
so the woman, the animus would be thinking and the anima would be feeling. Mm-hmm. And again, there might be some truth mm-hmm. to that. To give a unisex definition, it's where your thinking and feeling are distorted.
With the negative side.
Yeah.
Those figures,
yeah.
Right? Because when they're operating as they should, which they might not
yeah.
be perfect, this is in a perfect world, feeling and thinking would be, you would be filtering your thinking through your feeling function, correct? If those were working together.
You would be...
The feeling and thinking function would be...
They'd be in harmony.
Harmony.
Yeah. Right? And... you know, why do women marry guys that beat them up? Because they're not seeing straight. That's the animus. Why do guys at 65 throw away everything they've worked for to blank an 18-year-old? They're not thinking straight. Or they're not feeling straight. That would be the classic distinction. Where thinking and feeling is distorted. And you almost want to say to these people, what did you expect? Well, they weren't expecting. That's what the anima and animus do to us.
You could almost say, when you say disposition, you could almost say attitude, too, could you?
I mean, yes, you
my
could.
Attitude towards somebody's feeling about what I did, if it's like, you gotta be kidding me,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, dismissing it, then that's my negative animus. Because it's not valuing
right.
the emotional.
I think with disposition more, are you the type of person that generally does that? It's the general attitude. And it's people who are always basically happy. That's a disposition. I'm not. They're not very creative. So my disposition is more creative. Their disposition is more happy. What is the habitual way of responding? And normally we don't worry about any of this stuff until it gets us into trouble. So remember, this is really meant to be a therapeutic tool, not just a schema for the sake of it. So that was the first two words of the definition. of which, 124, of which the man himself is deeply unconscious. Okay, so far so good. Now, or as a stimulus to life that drives him to this woman and not to that one. So the eros that pulls you toward your relationships. And inclines him to this lifestyle and not that one. Is he a businessman? Is he an artist? Is he a professional? Is he a laborer? And so on. All of this, you see, we just say, well, people make choices. And what this is showing us, not really. They are on a conveyor belt. And your anima and animus is that conveyor belt. That now here, I think, gets a little more personal. That disposes his feeling to warmth and joie de vivre, or to a cold and lackluster outlook. So, does the individual have is there an affable, open-hearted person there or not? Would be the animus. Now back to the animus. I think of women who are in their 80s who are still engaged in life and politics and reading the paper and going to demonstrations and thinking about issues, where others are just sitting at home knitting or something like that. That former would be a developed animus. The mind is still engaged. And for the man, it would be his heart is still engaged. On the other side, seduces him to lust and sin. Same for anima and animus, I think. Now, that's what we're going to be talking about for the rest of the chapter. Lust, sin, and, look at the last word there, awakening.
I wonder why this one's more cheerful.
Pardon?
I said, no, wonder why.
Yeah, well, this is about erotic attraction. Yeah. And feeling good and going for what you want. And also finally brings him an awakening to himself. So what we're going to see is how eros, attractions, and consciousness work together. I think the great danger of psychology, and this is where Darrell's talk fit in, as you heard, though, living your nonsense, is that often these desires lead us into nonsensical things, where we learn something that we would never have learned otherwise. And if your view of life is, oh, I have to live a perfectly controlled, conscious life, you'll miss all these opportunities for growth. Okay, so what we do now is we interpret the Golden Ass, which is a book of von Trotz's, which he summarized here wonderfully in a few pages. It's also a great read if you want to give yourself a Christmas present. I guess it was written in the very first couple of centuries, if I remember, of the Christian era. By a guy named Apuleius, who was a philosopher. And you will all know the story Amor and Psyche, and that story is embedded in the narrative of the Golden Ass by Apuleius. What she's going to do then is look at all the figures in a traditional Jungian way and how they relate to each other. That's pretty much 124. So the story starts at the bottom. The hero is Lucius. From light, which already tells us what? Yes, but I don't think it's in that title, in that name. Well, it could be. I was thinking more, he's light.
He's going to darkness. As opposed to darkness.
Yeah, he's going to have to go into the darkness.
Yeah.
So
he's very masculine.
And he's on a white horse.
And he's on a white horse.
The hero, white man.
He's probably naive. He's probably arrogant.
Idealistic.
Right. Though I think in his case he's a cynic. But out of touch with the emotions and passions of his soul and body.
Cynicism is just ideal. I've heard idealism with despair. Idealism that has no hope of fulfillment becomes cynicism.
Idealism that has met frustration and turned to cynicism.
Yeah. And there's an idealism under there, you know, that is
that's true.
Not be realized.
Can't be realized. Probably because he's too lazy. But, you know, I've gotten to know these kids over at Butler these last couple of years, and that's the one thing that's hit me so strong. It's really tragic. I mean, a lot of these kids are wonderful, with wonderful minds, and great hopes, but they're lazy. And you can just see, 20 years, you're going to be a big fat cynic. Because if you want to... And I think the average psychologist would say, well, your ideals are unrealistic. Get realistic. I would say your ideals are right. You have to have the strength to fight for them and put them into being. It may take a whole lifetime. But they think they can just change the world in a couple of months. And I've seen some of them get out of college and just turn into ne'er-do-wells.
That's the thing about having unrealistic goals is you don't have to fucking attain them. You know, so... It's a creation of laziness to have goals that can't be reached, you know? Like, you make them so high and mighty, it's impossible, and then, like, okay, I'm not going to do that.
I don't necessarily think they're too high. Mm-hmm. But they don't have the backbone to pick a field of endeavor in which to fight and then make a difference. Yeah. For example, I knew one kid who was a psych major and was disgusted with the nature of their program. And I said, well, you know, I'm disgusted too. That's why I went to Europe and studied psychology. Oh, he was so excited. There's another way to do psychology. Yeah. And so I gave him a bunch of schools in the States where, for graduate work, where I thought you could at least get some more humanistic education and still get a doctorate degree. You know, and he never followed up. And so I asked the teacher, what's with that guy? And she said, oh, he's lazy. See what I mean? Mm-hmm. I think that fits because Lucius is not going to commit himself to anything before he goes through the anima experience here. Mm-hmm. And the anima experience here will lead him to the ability to connect.
One thing about misery is it makes... Drive the laziness out of you because you're fucking miserable. You have to do something. And that's
Like exactly.
You just can't keep going on, you know, with the status quo.
Absolutely. And he is going to take a journey into misery. Absolutely. So he goes off on his journey, and he meets man called Socrates, who is killed by two witches. So. Remember, we're doing this from the point of view of the anima. So the anima here is negative. And Socrates would represent the thinker, the pure thinker. So can you see how the anima starts to have a teleological function right away in the story? The poison in him kills his intellectualization. And that's what we're always looking for when we do this animus work. These things can't be explained by cause. They have to be explained by purpose. Shadow, you explain by cause. The anima and animus, by purpose. So the reason he's got such a negative anima is to destroy his intellectualism and his cynicism. And that will be the meaning of his misery. At least for a while.
Because the Socrates character is not connected to feeling in
right.
any way.
Right. I guess, in fact, at least, I don't know whether it's fact or legend, Socrates' wife, Xantippe, I believe it's pronounced, was known for being a nag. And her point is, that's the nature of the feminine when it's in relation to an intellectual masculine. It turns negative. So as it turned negative in Socrates' life, externally, it's happening in Lucius' life internally. And that's the negative animal.
And yet she's serving a higher function.
This is the difficulty. That negativity has often a very healthy purpose. Which is why we are a little loath to jump into the DSM, whatever it is now, 5. Because sometimes these negative looking storms, remember we're back to demons, aren't negative in the long term. They are trying to produce a positive change. Now, he then falls in with a witch. I think it's pronounced Pamphile, if I'm right. The great whore. And he takes a fancy to one of her pretty servants, Photis, the light. Now, that light of Photis is a different light than the light of his white horse. You follow that? Because the darkness of the unconscious is going to start guiding him.
She's the light in the dark.
She is the genuine light in the dark. In other words, if we can accept the messes that these animus demons lead us into by way of projection, there's a guidance within. But, as she points out, 2, 4, 6 lines down, the relationship is purely lust. And it's power. Then robbers storm the house. And Lucius is turned into an ass. You follow the role of the robbers and the ass? Final 125.
The robbers are stealing him from the actual experience of the dark, light in the darkness.
He's going to have to spend time with his own darkness.
Yeah.
Totally immersed in the shadow. Right? He's taken over by it. And he's actually not even in a human level. Like he's at a very, he's so far from his light side now. I mean, instinctive animal and can't even think.
He's
a beast.
He's turned into a party animal. This would be your fat boy. Mm-hmm. And why he needs to do that, it gets him out of his head. Gets him into his emotions, acquaints him with his body, but the way it appears, first of all, is very crude.
And the robbers are the personification of his inability to feel.
There again, what? As soon as we get into this animus stuff, everything we say has a double meaning, I think. And on the one hand, they're his crudeness, and that he was this cynical elite philosopher who was above life, and now he's acting like a pig. The negative side is it's not generally advisable to go around acting like a pig. The positive side is at least he's not an intellectual. So he's being pulled into experiences which on the one hand alienate him, but on the other hand, show him part of himself he hadn't known. It happens to be my story. Some of you have told my dream in divinity school. I was climbing up a ladder, up, 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 And then I got to the top, and there were no more rungs, and I started to fall. I thought, oh my God, this is going to be the end. And someone caught me, put me down. I turned around and thanked him. It was the devil.
Wow.
And I thanked him. He said, you're welcome. And he went one way, I went another. But there I was in this great intellectual, theological, mental trip. And then I fell into sex, drugs, and rock and roll. That's becoming an ass. But it got me out of the mind, which can't receive the spirit, into the body and the emotions, which can receive the spirit. But then, as we'll see, what was once a solution becomes the next problem. He's going to have to get out of being an ass. But he had to go through being an ass to get out of his head so he can get to his heart.
Do you have stories where the opposite is true? The guy's too much in his body and then the animal
is sure, yeah.
More of an intellectual?
Or, I don't know about intellectual, but certainly you could say the second part of the story is he's an ass, and then he's going to have to deal with the rose. I think today most people are not, most kids, at least I know, haven't been overly intellectualized. Because they've been having sex since 15 or 14 or God knows when. And they're already into the body. So their task would be more the rose.
So the fact that the robbers have given him, he's carrying your booty.
Yeah.
So there's the gem of the, if uncovered, could be the gift to him.
I would say they're just a crudeness with both the negative and positive meanings there. Negative because it's not human. Positive because he's at least going after what he wants, just not doing it very respectfully. Just take what they want. Yeah. Really, I think the frat boy is about as close as we get in our current experience. You know, I talk to these girls who go to frat parties, and they say, you know, I just feel uncomfortable. They just want to get laid. That's all they want. Mm-hmm. And then when they do, they say, and then the next day you don't even talk to the person. So it's just pure physicality. What does that look like? Bottom 125. It's an underworld that also opens up today in the psyche of every man who identifies with only the intellect and its false ideals, and it represses his development of feeling. So remember, we're talking about the anima in her first manifestation inwardly as negative. As he himself sees it, it is as if he were being inexplicably pursued by a negative fate, as if he were constantly running into cold and evil women, and as if the world's evil were intent on bringing all his ideals to nothing. In practice, one sees this in still another form, namely, that this kind of man is always withdrawing from life into depression, into a superior or lofty state of injury, sense of injury. In him, the negative anima becomes a resentment inimical to life. So the man dealing with an anima like this either gets caught in repetitive erotic messes or holds back and is above the fray. Now, apropos the anima and animus, I think in the old days, one would have said that the former getting involved in life is what the anima does to a man, and pushing her out of life is what the animus does to a woman. It makes the woman prone to attacking. Who wants to be around somebody who's attacking? So it isolates her. But you see here, she's just said that these things are now merging into various possibilities of the anima. So I think the animus can do the same. It can lure a woman into unsuccessful relationships, or it can push her into aloofness. And then so on from there. But you get a picture for the psychology we're dealing with. This is what an anima problem looks like. This is what a man with an anima who is a daimon looks like. Either he's entangled or he's aloof and superior.
So aloof and superior can't lead him where he needs to go, right?
No.
But being in the mess might have the possibility of something.
Yeah. Although, if he's lonely enough, he might start asking why. But he'll probably have to fall into the ass sooner or later anyway. Then he meets Charity.
Can I just ask one question?
Yes.
Is the negative mother archetype, is that part of the negative anima?
Yeah, I would say that the anima and the animus are tributaries from a larger stream of the negative mother, or in the case of the woman, the negative father. Or let's say the great mother and what would be the equivalent for the woman? The wizard, maybe. And those figures can be positive or negative.
But the great mother is also related to the devil, right? She's the devil's mother, so she's also related to the animus, or the negative animus as well in the fairy tale.
And, you know, there's early, we're talking pre-Christian myths, Babylonia, Samaria, the mother is both. She's the corn, and then every year she kills her son. So that's the archetype of the feminine, and the anima would be an expression of that archetype. Having both sides, and which side predominates is a function of that man's attitude toward himself, his unconscious in life. But no, I can't say that, but I was going to say this is the way it starts, but I don't think it's the way it starts always. But when there's a problematic relationship to these figures, there is a distortion in the ego as well. But none of us are perfect, and so all of us are going to have a piece of this drama in us one way or the other. And people who look like they escape in their 20s will get hit at 40 or 50 with this problem. Because as we'll see, the real issue here isn't merely the anima and animus, it's how do we get them to be a bridge to the self. That's what we're headed towards. In their best sense, when they're working, they lead us to our true destiny. But the problem is getting them in that state where they can do that, because in their unconscious state, they are their snares and traps. Well, another thing I like about the story is all this stuff's going on, and then we are told the fairy tale of Amor and Psyche. So look what she says. And here is something that never ceases to astound me. the tail, I'm about the middle of the last, of the second paragraph on 26. This tale comes, see where I am? Up like a dream from a deeper archetypal layer of the psyche, and is like a brief gleam of light in the dark night of misery and suffering. Lucius misses its meaning, etc. This is what you get out of dream work, I think. That if you're working with these projections and you're consciously experiencing the confusion, the unconscious starts to turn positive on its own. And that's then what we try to feed by continued work so that it, that positive process, gets stronger than the negative process. And it just happens, I can only say by grace. So we're going through all this crap, and then suddenly a story also starts appearing in the dreams, showing us why we're on this earth, what we can accomplish, what our strengths are, the kind of person that we are in the process of becoming if we stick out the dark aspect of it. And that's then what healing is for us. It's a spontaneous emergence. Well, I don't know if I need to read this story. I don't think I do. No, you probably know it. So she continues that idea of the positive aspect of the unconscious showing up in the midst of the, she puts it so well, misery and suffering. While Lucius is swamped in moods of lust, egotism, fear, and stress, and by ineradicable cynicism, the unconscious presents in the form of this story a secret underlying meaning of the situation. That's the healing aspect of the unconscious. That we can't create. We create the precondition for its emergence. The fate of his anima, who suffers from her proximity to and separation from the god Eros. I'll come back to Eros in a second. It is as if the unconscious were saying to him, behind your apparently meaningless and unhappy fate, a deeper drama is being performed, a divine play of the daimons, whose meaning is the redemption of the anima by the spirit of love. We get this word Eros. Of course, it's Eros and Psyche. But what is so important here is Eros is, of course, relatedness. And it's the desire and the capacity to emotionally connect, not only to an outer person, but also to yourself. So if there's no Eros, you cannot commit to yourself, just like your commitments to others will be faulty. So he has to go through this process in order to develop the state of mind that will allow him to give himself to the identity which is waiting for him in himself already. That's what I think is so powerful about this material. That identity, that this underlying meaning, this brief gleam of light is purely created by the unconscious. And then we receive it and act on it, but we don't create it. And if we were not redeeming our Eros, we would never notice what's being given to us, and we'd never commit to it. So that's that page. Well, how's your energy? Should we eat some more? I'd say we basically have gotten to 128. Maybe we'll do a little bit there and then we'll stop. The other thing is, this figure of charity is also a personification of the positive aspect of the anima. Positive aspect of the anima now being the ability to commit and to be emotionally engaged with the task of our life. Not defined by the collective, not defined by our profession, not defined by our neighbors, but defined by the inner voice within. And then we take it back to our neighbors, our profession, but it comes from the inside. Um, 128 at the bottom is simply a typical point of distraction along the road of this process that the man confuses physical and emotional beauty. She opens a box and falls unconscious by a cloud that is released.
But where are we?
Bottom of 128. It's just okay. A detail, really.
Okay.
Remember, he's an aesthete. And the aesthete is always in danger of equating the beautiful and the good. I told some of you one of my dreams recently, last couple of years, was about the cathedral in Strasbourg. I racked my brains. Why am I dreaming of the cathedral of Strasbourg? And then I came across a essay by Goethe to that cathedral. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It only has one spire. They didn't have enough money to put the second spire on. So it's still to this day, it's got one. It's a Gothic cathedral with a spire on one side. And then the people just criticize it for being ugly. And Socrates, that's a nice slip. Goethe wrote an essay in which he said, in praise of the cathedral, in which he says, art is creative long before it's beautiful. And that's what the aesthete, namely me, has to learn. We're doing this work. It at times is very unformed, very chaotic, but just because it's pretty doesn't mean it's wrong. Just because it's not pretty doesn't mean it's wrong. And that's what I think he's dealing with here, and what I have to learn too about my own creativity. Don't give it up because it's not finished. But the aesthete will do that. It's not a pretty product, so he goes from one pretty woman to woman to the other, one pretty idea to the other, and so on.
In the eulogy that Steve Jobs, you sent me, Sandy, mm-hmm. that Steve Jobs' sister wrote, she said he was willing to wait for the beauty to come when he created something. That's the same idea.
Same idea. If you think you really do equate beauty and truth, beauty and creativity. And I think that takes us to the middle of 129. Well, that's probably a good place to stop. What we're going to talk about next in the new year is it goes wrong again, but these steps of going wrong are always steps in which something important is learned that is needed for it to go right. So we've got him under the spell of the negative anima, meaning it's not yet conscious. We've looked at all the effects of that, and we've seen the thing start to change a little bit into the, that story that appears. We'll take another slide back and then we'll go on from there. And so, I think I had you read to 142. I don't know if we'll get any further than that. I'd say just stop there for the new year. Everyone got the dates for the new year? Did you get it? Okay, I don't know. I know you don't like to read that, so I printed out a copy.
Do you have an extra copy?
I have two copies.
Well, if it's not going to go straight, it has to go crooked.
Yeah. I like that. That sums up a lot. Thank you for that bit of wisdom, and I think we should dig in a little bit.